This is the hashtag STR Ask podcast brought to you by Stand to Reason. I'm Amy Hall, and Greg Kogel is here with me to answer your questions.
Hey, Amy, before you jump into it, let me just offer a thought that, because I just returned yesterday, actually, from the Philippines, where I had a wonderful time, the great church in Manila. And one of the things that happened is there were people who came to me and said, hi, I not only listen to STR Ask, but I sent in questions, and here's my handle, you know, do you remember me? And I said, no, I don't remember your handle. Maybe Amy does. But what was sweet is that it's clear that the impact of this podcast is international. And sometimes it's hard to envision that, isn't it, Amy?
Yeah.
When it's you and I talking here behind the mics, no audience, we don't know how God is using what we're doing. By the way, this is not just true for us. It's true for every single Christian who's listening. You never know who's listening in and how God is using the things that you're offering out of faithfulness to Him. So I don't want to make the loaves and fishes into a metaphor, because I think it's about the deity of Christ and the messianic office of Christ. There in John 6 and the other passages, it talks about God. Jesus did it twice. But there is, I'm just going to, that isn't its meaning, but I'm going to use it as a metaphor. There is a sense in which you give you give what you have to the Lord, just like that boy did, and even if it's modest, in the power of the Holy Spirit, He can multiply it to feed multitudes. And that's a lesson for every one of us to internalize.
Yeah, I think about that every time when I read where it says, you know, he says, what do we have? And they tell him, and he says, bring them to me.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, we bring our little bits to him, and then he makes something out of it.
Sure, sure. Yeah. Now, just again, to be clear, that is not the intention of the author, John. This is a metaphor. We see something similar happening in our own lives. The intention of John, in including, say, in the Bread of Life discourse, that incident, is to say something about Jesus and who he is, not about what God does with our gifts. That might be a secondary observation. It isn't the point of the text. Mm-hmm. That is actually something we learn from the kid who gave the stuff. But it isn't the reason John included it. John included it for a different reason. This is a little beef I have. Sometimes we take passages and make metaphors out of them and completely miss the reason that the author included that in the beginning. It's usually about Jesus, not about us.
Okay, well, let's start off with a question from Silence. His question.
A question from what?
Silence.
Silence. Isn't that kind of a
S-I-L-E-N-S.
Oxymoron? Huh?
S-I-L-E-N-S.
Oh, okay. I thought it was silence. I'm going to. Okay.
Okay, so here's the question. What are the greatest arguments against the simulation hypothesis, the idea that our world and universe is a simulation being run by a higher being in a deeper reality?
What are the best arguments against that? Okay, there's a presumption.
This is pretty popular right now.
Yeah, this is the Matrix view, basically. Am I right here?
Yeah, it would be something like that.
Okay.
Yeah.
There is a principle called the principle of credulity that comes from British philosopher, I always forget his name, wrote The Evolution of the Soul. You'll know his name if I said it. Very famous. He's emeritus now.
So still living?
Yeah.
All right, keep talking.
The principle of credulity, and he's made lots of contributions to Christian thinking. The Evolution of the Soul is one of his books that I had to read for philosophy of mind, British. And he has a concept called the principle of credulity. It's in the tactics book in the footnotes. And the notion of the principle of credulity is that things probably are the way we perceive them to be unless we have good reasons to believe otherwise. So if you have, you take a pencil and you stick it into the water and you see the refraction visually, it looks bent. Well, we know the pencil's not bent, even though it looks the way it's bent. I heard one comedian says, that's why I don't take baths, you know. But We know it's nothing's bent that goes in the water. It's a refraction. So things are the way they appear to be, unless we have good reason to think otherwise. It's called the principle of credulity, and all of our living, everyday living, is based on that. I think in the book I said this is a common sense principle that philosophers understand, and so does every all ordinary folk. We understand that too. Yeah, Richard Swinburne, exactly. Now, so I think this is not only, it's not a legitimate principle because the eminent British philosopher Richard Swinburne pointed it out. He's pointing out something obvious, okay, and then giving a name to it. So it reifies it a little bit. It makes it concrete for us. Okay, but this is the principle that we operate on all the time, and it allows our life to work. If instead we approached every circumstance with unmitigated skepticism, that is unrestrained skepticism, and we thought to ourselves, just because it's possible to be misled, it means that we maybe are being misled about whatever, we would not be able to live our life at all. Period. Mm-hmm. Life would be unlivable, quite literally. I just took a sip of water. Maybe there's poison in there. Well, maybe I won't drink that because there might be poison in there. But if I don't drink water, then I'm going to die. So you see the problems. Okay, this mm-hmm. is a very common sense notion, and which principle of credulity does not need to be defended. It's a self-attesting kind of truth. Okay, it's obviously true.
Self-evident.
Pardon me?
Self-evident.
Self-evident truth. Yeah, thank you. Good. That's why you get the big bucks. So that would be a response that I would offer against the matrix mm-hmm. concept. However, my response is a little out of line in this regard. What I teach in tactics is that the person who makes the claim, especially if it's controversial and it's extraordinary, has a burden of proof that that he or she bears to demonstrate why we should take the claim seriously. If somebody says something is so, and like I said, it's controversial, then it's their job first to give us reasons why they might think it's so. It is not our job to disprove it. So this is an example of that. If somebody thinks, what is the best argument against the matrix concept, my question is, what is the best argument for it? And if there's no argument for it, why would you think, because you saw Keanu Reeves in a movie, that this might be the way reality is constructed? And anyway, if that's the way reality is constructed, why would these people who are creating the matrix make the movie The Matrix so that you might be able to see behind their deception? You know what I'm saying? I mean, that doesn't make any sense. My principal response is going to be, you show me some good reasons for it, mm-hmm. and then I will deal with the reasons. If I have no good reasons for it, then I'm not going to have anything to refute, okay? However, on my side of the affair, I still have the principle of credulity, which is a foundational, solid rock concept that we all depend on that mitigates against the notion that we are in some kind of matrix.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't really have anything to add because that was the one thing I wrote down here was, he says, what are the arguments against? I said, well, what are the arguments
of course,
for?
Yeah. So by the way, this is instruction for our dear listeners, not just regarding an answer to the challenge, but to keep in mind not just what to think, but how to think. We have no obligation to answer this. What if? 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 What if my mother-in-law was a trolley car which she have wheels? You know, the famous Yiddish statement, I think, translated. In any event, I mean, you can what if all day long. It doesn't, so what? It doesn't do you any good. It might be fun to speculate, but don't act as if what if claims have any basis in reality, as if we are obliged to reject, or rather disprove them, or else they stand as legitimate claims about the way the world mm-hmm. is.
Okay, here is a question from Rolf Anderson. Some people fear asking God for strength or wisdom or faith because he will send them a tragedy or a heavy trial. How would you address such a fear of God and or fear of prayer?
Well, generally, the question or the prayer for strength or for wisdom is when the person is already in the tragedy or heavy trial. I mean, that's certainly the context of the directive to pray for wisdom in James 1. Consider it all joy, my brethren, when you encounter various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith, etc. But if anybody lacks wisdom in the context of those trials, let him ask of God. Okay. So generally, the circumstance is we are asking for wisdom and strength because the trial is already upon us. Okay. I don't ask for wisdom and strength unless I'm asking for wisdom and strength for some particular thing. So this seems to me like the cart is before the horse a little bit. As to being concerned that God will send them a hardship if they pray for something like praying for patience, well, God's not going to give you patience. He's going to teach you patience, basically. God doesn't just sprinkle pixie dust on us and make things happen. He uses means to his ends over time. That's almost universally true in Scripture and in Christian living. So in a certain sense, I'm sympathetic to the concern, but I think that it's wrongheaded. And I know you'll affirm this. There is whatever difficulties or hardships that God brings into our life, he brings for one reason, to make us more like Christ. And that has eternal consequences. Physical exercise, it profits little, Paul writes to Timothy, but godliness is a means of great gain, for it holds a promise not only for this life, but also for the life to come. You suffer a hardship in the power of the Spirit before God. You are investing in returns forever. And sometimes I know this is kind of a world-ish way of thinking about it, but when I think of things that I'm facing, and there are things that I've been facing for years that are difficulties, that are anguishes that may never get resolved in my life. And if I only had this lifetime, that would be very discouraging. This is why people, you know, have radical changes. This is why people get divorces. Hey, look at it. I got one life to live, like the commercial says, which is false. I got one life to live. I've got, you know, just my four score and 10. I'm halfway through that. It ain't working out. So I'm going to change the circumstances so I can finish out well. I'm going to get a new model, a wife, or something like that, you know. If that's all you got, these four score and tens, there's a certain sensibility to that. Okay, let's change strategies here. But that isn't all we've got. We know better. And that's an alteration that we're not allowed to make in our life because we make a pledge. So I'm talking about marriage here. But also, it misses the point that whatever befalls us on this side of the grave is an investment that brings returns forever. And the best passage for this is in 2 Corinthians 4, in which Paul, the last couple of verses of the chapter, Paul talks about, you know, there's a temporal perspective, there's an eternal perspective. We're in play for the eternal perspective because the natural man is decaying. He's falling apart. You know, this tent is withering away. But we realize this isn't the only factor. And then he says momentary light affliction is actually producing for us an eternal weight of glory, far beyond all comparison. And what I think gets overlooked quickly is the momentary light and is producing. Because when you read further in 2 Corinthians where this passage is found, we realize that by human standards, Paul's affliction is not momentary and it's not light. It is his lifetime that he endures, four times being whipped, 39 times. Four times 39 whips, three times beaten with rods, That's no fun. You get one with a whack with a rod. Okay. So a shipwreck, what, three times? Day and the night in the deep, et cetera, et cetera. He goes on and on and on, you know. Well, that doesn't sound like momentary. It doesn't sound like light. Well, he's looking at the eternal perspective. Mm-hmm. And then he says, it is that affliction that is producing an eternal weight of glory. The glory, this eternal weight of glory, there's going to be glory for every believer, but there's going to be different weights of it. And the eternal weight of glory is being produced by the hardship we endure in the power of the Spirit in our life. So when we say, I'm not going to pray that because I'm going to get in trouble, I understand that sentiment. That's going to bring hardship on me. Boy, I get it entirely. Trust me. However, when the hardship comes, for many people, anguish and difficulty and hardship and pain is completely wasted. But for the Christian, we have a promise. All things we know that God causes. We know that God causes all things to work for good for those who love him and who are called according to his purpose. For those whom he foreknew, that's us, he predestined to become. He didn't predestine everything, in my view. He didn't cause everything to happen. It's not a machine universe, but he guaranteed that we would become his children conformed to the image of his son. And that's what he's using these circumstances to accomplish.
I love the idea that you brought in of the eternal perspective, because I think that's so important. And because I've had this happen to me many times where I've prayed for wisdom or faith or whatever, and I have had horrible things happen, and so I...
Amy, you're not helping this poor person who's asked the question.
Well, that's why I kind of had a chuckle when I read this, because this is something I had to think about, and I actually did think about, because I could see it happening. And I think what it comes down to is you have to love God and want to know him more than you hate your pain. Mm-hmm. And you have to desire that wisdom more than you desire comfort. Mm. As long as you desire comfort more than you desire wisdom, then you're not going to be willing to go through anything to get that wisdom.
And you're going to get what you desire. You're going to get comfort. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And not just wisdom, but the rest of the package that I just described.
Right, right. So I just wanted to read this a few verses from Proverbs 3 here, starting in verse 13. How blessed is the man who finds wisdom and the man who gains understanding, for her profit is better than the profit of silver and her gain better than fine gold. She is more precious than jewels, and nothing you desire compares with her. And it goes on and on to describe mm-hmm. this beautiful...
Well, the first 10 chapters almost mm-hmm. of Proverbs is largely an ode to wisdom and the benefits of pursuing wisdom.
So when Rolf asks, how do you address such a fear of God and or fear of prayer? The first thing I would say is you need to increase your desire for God by understanding who he is better and seeing who he is. But also you have to trust him, because if I know that if I pray for wisdom and then he'll bring some trial into my life, I have to trust that there's a purpose for it. I have to trust that there is a good reason and that he's has my good in mind. Mm-hmm. If I don't trust that, then I'm going to be afraid of God.
Right, right.
But we have no reason to be afraid of God, because he's promised us how he's going to treat us, mm-hmm. and even through sufferings. So until you trust God... But again, and this is something people have to figure out, trusting God does not mean trusting that everything will turn out right. And that's something I think in this country...
Turn out comfortable.
Right. Yeah. Oh, thank you. Everything will turn out comfortable. And I think that's a misunderstanding a lot of people in this country have. And
right.
So when something goes wrong, we have to figure out, well, what does it mean to trust God? Because I was trusting God and look, I have this trial now. And then you have to figure out, you have to work through the fact that trusting God means having faith that what he says will happen, mm-hmm. The things that we can't yet see, that they will happen, that we will be made like Christ, that he won't leave us, that he has our good in mind. And that all, it takes some time to work through, but if you don't, you'll miss out.
Well, I want to underscore this comment you just made. It takes some time to work through. Trust us here on this one. We are both very sympathetic to the struggle that people have with trying to make this a reality in their life, because I think it's true for most Christians. It is. The writer of Hebrews says in chapter 12, all discipline for the moment seems not to be joyful, but sorrowful. And so it is completely understandable if we are going through these difficulties, and it's hard and confusing and sorrowful, and we are asking God, are you faithful in this? Why this for me now? And I think it's entirely legitimate to ask those questions. David says in Psalm 13, he said, how long, O Lord, will you desert me forever? How long will you hide your face from me? How long will I take counsel in my heart? While having sorrow in my heart all the day, how long will my enemy be victorious over me? How do I know those passages, Amy? What do you think? because Psalm 13, it's easy one to remember. That's the unlucky number, right? Because this is part of my prayer life, okay? So we are sympathetic to someone struggling with that. But as you read the rest of the psalm, you see that David glorifies God at the end, that he is faithful. It's sometimes hard to say the rest of that psalm with confidence. In the beginning, we could say with confidence. At the end, it comes as a result of growth. So we're sympathetic to the challenge here, but we still want to tell you the truth in the midst of that difficulty.
All right. Thank you, Greg, and thank you, everyone, for listening. Send us your questions on Twitter with the hashtag STRAsk, and we look forward to hearing from you and answering your questions. This is Amy Hall and Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason.